Affairs will come to order. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Good morning.
We have House Bill 2341 up today, and I hope you all have your materials. It's an extensive bill, and we will have extensive presentations today. So, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2341 and call forward Jessica Harris, who is just now entering the room. Welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I apologize for my tardiness this morning. For the record, my name is Jessica Harris, and I'm here on behalf of the Associated General Contractors, and also here in my role this morning as the co-chair of the stakeholder group that has worked on this bill. I've got a bit of a cold this morning, so I'm going to sound like I have I think this morning, before we start through the section-by-section analysis, I'd like to take a moment and highlight the differences in the current law between procuring public procurements and procuring a public improvement. As you heard this guest on Friday, public procurements, even the standard there is low bid. That is especially true in the public improvement section. There is quite a bit of statute that directs public improvements, i.e. roads, bridges, anything that we consider also here as a capital improvement. Those things must be procured by low bid, unless otherwise exempted. And going through the exemption process for a public improvement is quite the process. You have to make findings, and then you have to have a hearing on the findings in order to give people a time to comment. The common kinds of alternative contracts, i.e. ones that you go through an exemption to do, are CMGC, Construction Manager General Contractor. And these kinds of procurements allow for the public agency to consider things other than, obviously, price, to consider expertise. It also allows the agency to bring the contractor in up front and work with the design team to facilitate a faster construction project and also a more technically complicated construction project. A good example of CMGC projects include projects at the airport, where you are interested in trying to move projects along quickly. You've got a lot of people in a small space, you're on a tight timeline, and you want to get those projects turned quickly. Also, projects where there are safety concerns, i.e. you're trying to add on a wing to a high school and you're doing it during a school year, you've got lots of kids around, and it's technically complicated. Those are instances where you want to work with the designer up front so that you make sure that those projects are handled correctly, where safety concerns can be addressed up front, where timing and scheduling issues can be all integrated so that everyone's on the same page. On the highway side, design build is a way that we work on alternative contracts. And these are especially effective if you're doing a bridge, for example, and the bridges are the similar. You may want to go to a design build format, which again brings the design team and the contractor in together to provide a proposal to, in this instance, ODOT. And those proposals, again, include additional scheduling, additional partnering, those kinds of formats that have proven successful. The key to alternative contracting, the reason why I'm going on about this is you will hear extensive testimony from some people on the benefits and downsides of alternative contracting for public improvements. But the benefit of public of alternative contracting tends to be for projects that are technically complex or have safety concerns or timing issues. It is a tool in the toolbox. It is not always the effective method of contracting, and AGC in particular and other associations encourage the use of alternative contracting only in instances where it's the right tool. There are instances where CMGC and design build are used, and it's a poor use of that tool because it's not the right kind of project. However, there are many instances where without that tool, it would have been a disaster of a project. But design bid build, the idea that you have a designer, an architect, an engineer design the project, you put it out to bid, you award it to the low bidder, and then you build it, is the standard for public improvements. And the way the public is protected in those instances is through bonding. A contractor is required to carry both a payment and a performance bond, although the current statute is a little confused about some of the language around that. But you carry a full bond. So in the instance where a contractor fails to perform or performs badly, the agency is covered to the full extent of the contract price. So they can recover everything that they paid the contractor. A payment bond is in the instance where the contractor does not or fails or refuses to pay its subcontractors or employees. And that bond protects them and material suppliers, etc., so that they can come recover against the payment bond. They're two separate bonds so that both parties are held harmless. So that's kind of the essential differences of public improvements versus public procurements. Wanted to give you kind of a general overview of that so that as you hear testimony about the current law, it's relatively clear. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dugan, who will start that.
Question, Representative Rosenbaum. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question about the comments you just made. What you were describing, is that the current law? And does this bill make any changes as far as responsible bidder language as it would apply to the CMGC situations?
Chair Close, Representative Rosenbaum. The current language does not change the exemption process. We went through that section, which is highly contentious word by word, and we made minor changes, mostly on formatting. It does not change the responsible bidder language, which again is a highly negotiated piece of law. It does not change the requirements for CMGC. It does add a process for going through an RFP process. But what I just described is current law and current practice.
Thanks. Thank you. Okay, continue.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Dugan Petty. I'm the Deputy Administrator with the Procurement, Fleet, and Surplus Services Division of the Department of Administrative Services, and I am one of the three co-chairs. I appear before you today to help go through on a section-by-section basis this bill. I would ask Madam Chair's indulgence as well as the rest of the committee. We'll try to set the pace about right. It's real easy to get lost in detail on this, so I'm going to try to keep it up at what I think is a reasonable level. If you want more detail, slow me down and ask. Okay. And if you want less detail, just speed us up, and we'll try to get it about right. This presentation today, depending on how far we get through all the sections in this bill, will involve myself, Jessica Harris, Bill Nestle, and probably Dana Andrews, all of which have expertise in different areas of this. This came together as a collaborative effort with task groups, and so it's very hard for any one person to have the detailed knowledge of this entire bill, and so we'll split that presentation up, and I think that'll be easier for the committee as well to hear from different people as opposed to zoning out on one person. So I'll start, and I'm going to start with Section 1. Very simple, it's just the short title of the bill, but what's different about it is it establishes a public procurement code, which I think imparts kind of a broad-based coverage of this business of public contracting, and it, in fact, it says public contracting code, covering not just state agencies, but all public agencies. So it's this concept of an overall code. And when we talk about the code, we talk about these three different subdivisions, these three different chapters now form the code. And it's even conceivable to think that if in the future the legislature decided to add another chapter providing policy and guidance regarding this business of public contracting, that that would be a part of the code. Section 2 involves definitions. I'm not going to go into any detail on definitions other than to say that we really have tried to make this more user-friendly for both the supplier community and the public agencies by including kind of the definitions as they relate to the code, all three chapters. We've also picked up some other definitions that are in other sections to identify those, so that if you're using this code, you can go to one place and find out what the meaning is, what the definitions are that are used. Now, each of the other portions of the bill, 279B and 279C, to the extent that they have differing definitions, will have their own definitions chapter as well at the beginning. But we think that this is a more user-friendly way of understanding what this law means. Currently, it's a little tricky. You can find a definition in one area that applies only to several sections, and if you're not careful and you think that definition has a broader meaning, you'll misinterpret some other portion of statute. Section 3 is policy. I guess I would summarize current policy in ORS 279 to talk a lot about competition and the ways in which we can measure competition, not just competition in the normal sense of does everybody get an opportunity to know about it, but competition in terms of delivery, competition in terms of value. A lot of discussion around competition, but it doesn't go much beyond that. I think a public contracting code needs to cover areas besides just competition. And so there's been a lot of thought that's gone into this suggested change. These really are values that would come from the legislature that would guide contracting in the public arena. And the first one is to simplify, clarify, and modernize procurement practices so that they reflect market and industry standards. And I think that's important. We all heard 10, 15 years ago about $800 screwdrivers that the Department of Defense was buying, or very expensive toilet seats. Part of the problem there was that they were buying things in a special kind of way that didn't really reflect industry standards or market standards. And any time we get very far off, particularly given the size of our contracting, which is, on the overall scheme of things, usually not large enough to drive an industry very far. So anytime we get very far off of market-based standards and the way things are conducted in the marketplace, we don't serve the citizens of Oregon well, because we probably don't get a very good deal, and we're kind of working against the grain. So simplify, clarify, and modernize so that the practices reflect marketplace and industry standards. Second point, instill public confidence through ethical and fair dealing, honesty and good faith on the part of government officials and those who do business with the government. Above everything else, a public procurement process has to have integrity. If there's not trust in how these decisions are made, the system doesn't work. So this is really about integrity, public confidence, fair dealing on the part of everybody who's a player in this public procurement system. The third point is to promote efficient use of state and local resources, maximizing economic investment in the public contracting within the state. So, we ought to be all about using our resources in the most efficient and effective way possible. We want to get the best deal, we want to get the best value, and we also want to do it in a way that leverages our resources so it's not administratively overburdened. Fourth point is clearly identify rules and policies that implement each legislative mandated socioeconomic program that overlay public contracting and accompany expenditure of funds. The legislature has a prerogative of establishing social economic programs about how we spend money. Emerging small business, minority businesses, local preferences, those are prerogatives of the legislature. Once those are expressed, our job is to implement them effectively as an overlay on this public contracting process. Apply impartial and open competition, protecting both the integrity of the public contracting process and the competitive nature of public procurement. We've written the competitive portion of this a little more broadly, but our intent with this is to really bring in all of that narrative currently in policy under 279.005 that talks about competition. And the final point of policy is to provide public contracting structure that can take full advantage of evolving procurement methods as they emerge within various industries. Part of the difficulty we have with the current public contracting process is it hasn't kept up with the way we do business in the market today. We are kind of an anachronism, sitting back here, trying to conduct our business the way we conducted it when we weren't buying major computer systems, we were buying typewriter ribbons and typewriters. Things have changed, we haven't kept up with that. So the first half of this statement is that we really need to be evolving. We need to have a procurement code that allows us to keep up with that and develop new techniques so we can be effective in carrying out the public's business. The second part of this sentence says, in effect, that we want to preserve the competitive bidding as the standard for public improvement contracts unless otherwise exempted. Now, with respect to public improvement, design, bid, build process that Jessica's talked about has been the standard and has worked reasonably well. There is already an exception process, so we weren't trying to push that into a new area, but we were trying to, in this code, allow this part that didn't really keep up to be kept up with a little bit of innovation, yet preserving the invitation to bid as the standard for public improvements. Section 4 talks about the organization of this chapter. And essentially what it does is it says, if it's a public improvement, public works, if it is architectural engineering or related services, it's covered under 279C. If it's anything else, it's covered under 279B. And 279A addresses both of them. So the 279A part is the overarching policies that the legislature would have that would govern whether it's public improvement or whether it's buying pencils.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we also are concurrently with this going to try and explain to you issues that we're going to try and address in kind of an omnibus amendment that we are working on at this moment, the Legislative Council. One of the key points that we really need to make clear in this code is that provisions in 279B and provisions in 279C apply only to those sections. And so we are working to provide clarity, and part of that amendment will be to strengthen Section 4 in addition to adding a section in the front of 279B and 279C, clarifying this policy so there is no confusion about overlap of these sections, because without that you'll see unintended consequences in both B and C, and we would hate to see that happen.
Section 5 is a new section, although it gathers up, I think, a lot of existing statute and tries to put it in some kind of order, and it's the application of the public contracting code. It says, except as otherwise provided in subsections 2 and 3 of the section, the public contracting code applies to all public contracting. And then it goes on to say, basically, the public contracting code doesn't apply to certain types of procurements, and it goes on to say it doesn't apply to certain entities' procurements. Now, no one can take a look at existing 279 and figure out who's in and who's out, what's in and what's out. Some things are spelled out as exemptions in 279.015. In state purchasing, some things are identified as they don't have to go to DAS or they don't have to go to competitive bid. But there's no one place that you can find out who's covered as a public entity and what's covered and what isn't covered. So this is an attempt to say this chapter applies to everything. And if it's not covered, then it's listed as an exception. So what we've done in these sections, Section Sub 2, the Public Contracting Code doesn't apply to contracts between contracting agencies, between contracting agencies and federal government, insurance, service contracts, contracts with professional witnesses, dispositions of real property, interest in real property. Those are, for the most part, as near as we can tell, pretty consistent with what's not covered already. There was some confusion, like around real property, what was covered, what wasn't covered in terms of disposal. And so we tried to make it clear that, those are not covered. And then under, I should mention that under 2L, sub 2L, public contracting code does not apply to any other public contracting of a public body specifically exempted from the code by another provision of law. The way our law is put together is if you find out the authorities scattered throughout the statutes, and those authorities may give a public entity the right to contract, and in some cases it would say they can enter into contracts. Some cases it will say they're not subject to provisions of 279. It's very difficult to tell without doing extensive research on an agency-by-agency basis. Even then, it's not particularly clear who's in and who's out. So this tries to capture this in one place. And I would hope that in the future, as laws change, as authorities change, as agencies, new agencies may be created, old agencies go away, that this could be updated at one point so people who want to conduct business understand who's covered and who isn't covered. Section 6, federal law prevails in case of conflict. This is a similar section to what currently exists.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you very much. I just want to be clear under Section 5, then, all of the exemptions listed currently exist under current law. There are no changes.
That is my understanding. That they currently exist in one form or another, and there are undoubtedly some that exist that we didn't catch that may be not reflected in here, so it may not be completely inclusive, but it's our best shot to identify who they are and put them in here.
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, we have not changed policy with regard to who's in or who's out. We have not tried to take people away or add them in. And that catch-all phrase that Dugan talked about ensures that if we haven't listed them here, they still retain their authority to be independent of 279 or inclusive of 279 as laid out in their statute. So we have not effected a policy change here.
Thank you.
Continue.
Section 6 is the federal override provision, and what this does is ODOT is a good case in point for this, but in the event that they get federal highway funds and those highway funds have policies or written policies or rules or a federal statute that somehow would conflict with our statutes or our rules, then those federal rules override ours to the extent of the conflict. It's a pretty common provision, and it's an existing statute. We've made it a little more specific to say that the override is to the extent of the conflict. I think arguably under the way ours is right now, you might say you set it aside and you do it not to the extent of the conflict. So it may be narrowed in its application to some degree. Authority in Section 7 really sets out procurement authorities, and it says, except as otherwise provided, public contracting code, a contracting agency shall exercise all rights, powers, and authority in accordance with the provisions of this public contracting code. This was a difficult area to work through because the grant of authority to contract for local governments really doesn't come from the state. It comes from local charters or ordinances that they have. Yet, as 279 is currently constructed, when they're exercising that authority, they are obliged to exercise it in accordance with the public contracting law, 279. So we've tried to preserve that with respect to the local agencies and be not make any changes there. And then we've come in and talked about, except otherwise provided in the public contracting code, for state agencies, the director of the Department of Administrative Services has all the authority necessary to carry out the public contracting code. And we've listed those authorities, many of which are currently in 712 and 727, and we try to kind of organize them in one place and so they're scattered instead of being scattered around to say who's got the authority and what authorities do they have. Now, we've been more specific with the state agency's authority, and we've been very broad in the local government's authority. We go on in sub 3 to talk about the authority that the director of the Department of Transportation has, which is what authority the director of transportation has now. But if you look through 279, it's not at all clear what that relationship is for ODOT purchases versus normal state agency purchases. In some cases, they have authority to purchase, but other things that they buy, such as office supplies, they don't have authority to purchase. So we've tried to make that clear by saying what their authority is. We've gone on to talk about the authority of the Secretary of State, and we've identified the authority of the state treasurer, because both of them, as near as we can tell in our review of statute, are subject to ORS 279, but they exercise their own authority. They are, incidentally, unlike the legislature, the court system, who, as near as we can tell, are not subject to 279, and so they've been, in Section 5, identified as this not applying to them. And finally, in Sub 6 of Section 7, we've identified some specific limited authorities that are subject to the provisions of the Public Contracting Code, and what this does is these are authorities in current statute that they're subject to 279, but they're not subject to gas procurement of their supplies and services, but in certain instances. So, for example, the State Department of Fish and Wildlife
procured, supervised the procurement of all goods, services, public improvements, personal services relating to dams, fishway ponds, and related fish and game propagation facilities. Those are current authorities that they have, and we've tried to gather them up and express them in here. There is at least some interest in parks for us to clearly identify their responsibilities, and we have to catch that in an amendment, and that had to do with back at a time when parks and ODOT were all part of the same agency. When they split, I'm not sure all those authorities got codified in the statute to split, so we may have to pick that up in the amendment. We're looking at that.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Duke, and I noticed in this section the mention of textbooks under the Department of Education, and can you tell me donations which would be received, say, by a school of books? Is that also an exception to this statute, or how are we able to receive things that are given without violating public contracting?
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, we have specifically said in the application of the code that the code does not apply to grants, and then we have defined grants, and I believe that could be considered a grant. We had some discussion about gifts and bequests and whether or not that needed to be specifically exempted, and we dropped that language out. My understanding was that there's other provisions in statute that allow for the acceptance of gifts and bequests. And
section, page 2, does it right here? Grant is defined, Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, to include gifts, bequests, commodities or other assets from a grantor for the purpose of supporting or stimulating a program or activity of the contracting agency. So in other words, yes, those gifts and bequests can be accepted, and they're not required to be acquired through a competitive process. We specifically included grants because in our estimation, and especially in the estimation of the Housing and Community Services Department, that the receipt of grants from the federal government may need to be competitively acquired, which is beyond absurd, for example, because you don't go out for a competitive process to acquire a grant. That's you make an application and you hope and pray you get it. So it is because you acquire it, and because the acquisition of things is subject to the code, we specifically exempted grants, and we have worked hard to create language, for example, from grants from the federal government for highway projects, to ensure that the acquisition of the grant itself is exempt, but the use of that grant money is not exempt, so you still have to contract it out. But in the instance of textbooks, yes, we have exempted the gift or the bequest of those books from the public contracting code.
Thanks.
Section 8 covers personal services contracts. This section is currently an existing statute, although it's largely been reworked, but it does two things. It allows, it says if you're a state agency, you go to someplace else to deal with personal services contracts, and then it talks about each contracting agency, so this is the broadest sense, is authorized to enter into personal service contracts, shall create procedures for the screening and selection of persons to perform personal services. And then we talk about a local contracting agency review board by ordinance, administrative rule, or other regulation may designate certain services contracts or class of service contracts as personal services contracts. This allows for local governments to define what is a personal services contract, and if they choose to do so, prescribes rules for source selection around personal services contracts. For the state agency piece, which points over to Section 18, in Section 18, we talk about DAS being responsible for acquiring certain contracts of public agencies. State agencies, the way we've treated them in the statute is to require their source selection methodology for personal services contracts to be the same as the source selection methodology for any other kinds of contracts. The reason we did that
at least in DAS's case, is because if it's a personal services contract, we've wound up going down one route, very complicated. People never know for sure exactly what the procurement process is, yet if it's just a regular trade services contract, we go down a different route. Personal services contract is primarily something, as we define it in DAS, is sort of intellectual in nature. It might be a consultant study. It might be accounting work. It could be the design of an information technology system. It's not, for example, a janitorial contract or a custodial contract, which would be a trade services contract. Sometimes, I think, because we've got two different processes for procurement, people try to figure out which process has got the least resistance to head down and try to define that in a way so that they head down that track of least resistance. I think we can make this a whole lot easier by having an effective, simplified procurement track and put all of them down that same one. And then, from a contract standpoint, simply put in the requirements you need for the services contract versus a personal services contract. Section 9 deals with local contract review board. Now, this exists in current statute, but it has been changed. In current statute, a local government may form a local contract review board by ordinance or charter or local legislation. They are obliged, once they do that, to file it with the county. And one of the major changes here is it no longer requires that filing with the county. It saves, I think, some steps around forming a local contract review board. If a public body doesn't form a local contract review board, then it becomes, by default, a local contract review board. So this is a section that deals only with non-state agencies, because in the case of state agencies, then the director of DAS has that authority. And this is one of the difficulties of trying. We talked about the broad scope of this covering local governments as well as state agencies. It's been difficult to try to balance that throughout this, and that's what this is about. Model rules is covered under Section 10, and we have made only minor changes to this section, but what it means is that if you're a state agency, including some of the state agencies that are listed under the application of the chapter as being exempt from the chapter, but if you're a state agency, then the DOJ model rules would apply. I misspoke. That's not correct. It only applies to those that are included in this chapter. But if you're a state agency or a public agency, DOJ's model rules apply unless you adopt your own set of rules. So this gives the Department of Department of Justice their responsibility to craft model rules to implement this code. And those model rules, and the reason they call them model, is that they apply not only to state agencies, but all public contracting agencies. Now, a public contracting agency can establish its own rules if it chooses to, and we have authority in Section 11 that allows them to do that. But if they don't establish their own rules, then they would be subject to DOJ's model rules.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is an especially important provision. This requirement of the Department of Justice was implemented just a few years ago with the goal for small businesses and for business people who contract with the government across all spectrums to have a consistent set of rules and policies and procedures for contracting with the government as it was before it was scatter. Requirements. There's still concern among the business community that some of the rules and implementation are still kind of scattershot. But this goes a long way to making those requirements consistent, and this is an excellent provision which we've retained.
And could I ask, is there still public input to the rulemaking process? You've listed ORS 183.310. Does that still include public input?
Madam Chair, yes, it does. In fact, that outlines a procedure and hearings process for providing that kind of comment. And this section, and especially as this section will apply to the adoption of this code, we've already begun discussions with the Department of Justice about their rulemaking process and their desire to bring in as many groups as possible and provide for public comment early on so that the rules adopted under this new code, if passed, would involve as many stakeholders as possible in that rulemaking process.
Thank you.
Section 11 also deals with rulemaking, and this is the rulemaking as it relates to contracting agencies or other public agencies. And it says that they may adopt rules necessary to carry out the provisions of the Public Contracting Code, including but not limiting to rules for procurement, management, disposal, and control of goods, services, personal services, and public improvements under the Public Contracting Code. Goes on to provide, so that's the broad authority for all contracting agencies, local governments, state agencies, all contracting agencies. And then it goes on in sub 2 to give the director of the Department of Administrative Services the ability to adopt rules governing procurement, management, disposal. Sub 3, the ODOT director, the authority to adopt their rules for what they have authority to do. And Secretary of State in sub 4, and finally in sub 5, the Treasurer. So this kind of tracks back to the authority. Where they have the authority, they can adopt rules around that authority. If you look at current 279, it's very difficult to understand who's got what authority to adopt rules. And in some cases, there are sections that are specific that reference some rulemaking authority, but there's really no section that references overall, at least for state agency, rulemaking authority for DASC. So it may have been there at one time, but over the years it seems to have been lost, and it seems like this is an important piece. Who has the authority to adopt rules? What is that authority? And how does that interrelate to the DOJ model rules? So we think we've gathered them up, put them in one place so people can see them and understand them. Delegations of authority. Currently, under Section 12, delegations, currently we have received advice that in some cases where there is a named person, for example, like the Director of Administrative Services, that person, under certain circumstances, does not have the authority to delegate. Well, it's not practical that the Director of Administrative Services would do everything that they are referenced to in the statute. Recently, in fact, the last 2 years, we've had cases where the Director of Administrative Services had to take a couple of days out from the schedule to conduct a hearing because it couldn't be delegated to a hearing officer for an ODOT pre-qualification denial. So what happened was we conducted that hearing. We had our chief procurement officer and our attorney working on conducting it, and we had the Director of Administrative Services actually presiding over it. But it's not a good use of their time. They should be able to delegate. But when they delegate, they need to determine that the person who they delegate that to has the capability of carrying out that delegation. Now, that holds for both the Director of Transportation and the Director of Administrative Services. The setup for state agencies in this statute is that authority goes to the Director of DAS. So DAS then, the Director of DAS, would have the ability to delegate certain procurement authority to state agencies or to individual persons after they've determined that that agency or that person has the capability of carrying out that authority. We also say in here that any delegation that's made must be subject to the rules and the statute. So you can't have some confusion about, well, I'm going to delegate this to you, so I didn't have to somehow follow some rule or statute in that delegation. It's got to be subject to the statute.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is new. Under current statute, a whole bunch of people have authority. We don't necessarily know who those folks are. Director of DAS, and by virtue of current statute, again, specifically named people are responsible for certain sections of the code. This provides a whole new level of accountability for state agencies and for the personnel who are specifically named. This is an excellent piece of work on the part of those who put it together, because I think this brings back some of the accountability, trust, and faith in government sections that we were talking about in the policy. This will enable us to better track how those procurement authorities are working and the positives and negatives of certain agencies and how they procure. things.
Madam Chairman, that takes us into Section 13, which is the Minority Women and Emerging Small Business section. And Bill Nestle is going to join us now to go over a bit of the detail, but I can just, while Bill's making his way up, say that these different provisions in existing statute were in different areas, and we tried to round them up and put them in one place and order them so they had some kind of logic to them so people could understand, look at them in one place, understand how they interrelate and apply them appropriately. Bill?
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bill Nestle. I'm with the Oregon Department of Justice, and I've had the privilege of being able to work with the task force chair people in attempting to draft the provisions of this article. At this point, I'm addressing the minority women and emerging small business enterprise provisions that are sections 13 to 15 of the Act. In this area, I think it can be very much stated that, except perhaps for a couple of things that I'll explain in section 15, this is merely housekeeping. This is an area of the law in which the task force decided to really keep it in a holding pattern for a whole lot of reasons. Number one, of course, is the way the U.S. Supreme Court is looking at affirmative action. Right now they have a case in the educational area involving the University of Michigan. And in the past 12 years they've handed down other decisions that have limited affirmative action. So in turning to Section 15, I'll just state that that is a virtual direct counterpart of existing 279.053. And the first part of it is actually, in addition to the definition, you have in subsection 2 just a rule of construction that says nothing in this code is to be construed as prohibiting whatever affirmative action programs may be undertaken. And then the other indicates that there is room by appropriate ordinance resolution or rule under which a contracting agency can limit competition to emerging small business enterprises and for all contracts that are for goods or services and for any other public contract that costs $50,000 or less. That is part of the existing law. Section 14 has its counterpart in ORS 279.116. It's also just a housekeeping rewrite of existing law. Section 15 is the discrimination prohibition. That currently exists in ORS 279.111, only we've done a few different things in this. Number one, we think we have clarified what was the original intent by indicating that when there is a false certification of non-discrimination made in a bidding document, or when a contractor does discriminate against someone because they are registered as or listed as an MWESB, then the appropriate responses are either debarment, which means that that outfit for a period of time not to exceed 3 years will no longer be qualified to bid on or propose on contracts offered by the public body that experienced the disqualification in its contracts. This is not a statewide debarment. It just is a debarment with respect to the agency that makes a determination that that unlawful activity took place in one of its contracts. Number two, in subsection 3, we have added a statute of limitations. There was a fear that, gosh, if you found out that somebody had discriminated in 1975 and yet that corporation had a whole new board of directors and a change in the way it viewed life, why reach back that far? So this is a 3-year statute of limitations subject to a discovery rule. And with those changes, this pretty much is just housekeeping that incorporates existing law with respect to MWESBs and affirmative action.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Section 16 and 17 deal with contract preferences. The first section, Section 16, deals with non-resident bidders, the reciprocal preference and the tie preference that we spoke at length about on Friday. These sections are found in 279.021 for the tie preference and 279.029 sub 2 sub B for the reciprocal preference. These sections have not changed policy. We have not attempted to broaden or lessen their scope over the public contracting process, and so they remain as they are in current statute. We have attempted to bring them together so that they are found in one section. Right now they are separated, one in the award process and one just kind of up front in the general contracting process, and so it's very easy for contracting agencies to necessarily lose those. We have put them together under one section and have tied award processes throughout 279B and 279C to look back at the contract preferences in Section 16 and 17. Additionally, Section 17 deals with contract preference.
Excuse me just a minute. Yeah. Representative Schaffler has a question.
Thank you. If we had this, would that license plate company still be making license plates for Oregon and in the state of Oregon?
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, we did have these provisions when the license plate issue was levied. Mm-hmm. That there was no tie preference on the contract didn't come in at the same price. So that the tie preference wouldn't have applied, and the reciprocal preference didn't apply because the province, Canada, didn't have a reciprocal preference on themselves. They didn't have a percentage that they would have applied against Oregon companies should we have gone to bid there.
Representative Garrard.
And I might mention that in one of our public meetings, we dealt with this subject in that there are two kinds of license plates. There are metal license plates and there are printed license plates. And as a result of that, there are two separate kinds of procurement rules, one that applies to metal license plates and one that applies to printed materials, which is what the special license plates come under. So there's nothing simple, Mike.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, what you don't see in this statute specifically is a provision that's in 282 that deals with a printing preference. And Oregon grants a 12% in-state printing preference to Oregon printers. That preference is kind of what was in play with the license plate issue, in which I'm going to let TASS and the Department of Justice address that more specifically. But that preference was not moved into this statute at the request of those that deal with the printing preference. We did not drag that into 279. It still sits in that section of law, and we will tie a reference to that so that those who are dealing with the contracting code are aware of that preference as well as they award contracts.
Representative Merkley.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'd like to return briefly to 13 and 14. Just make sure I understand. There is no mandate that a certain percentage of a contract be set aside for limited competition, for affirmative action, or for small businesses. This is simply an authority to do so, and it's authority that has no cap except in a monetary value of the contract.
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, that is correct.
So if, for example, the state was letting out contracts for landscaping, and they were all below $50,000, 100% of them could be set aside by the agency in these categories?
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Section 17 deals with preferences for recycled materials. These sections are currently found in 279.545 to 279.650. This is a broad current section of law that deals with everything from these preferences that you see here to including a section on the legislative recycling program, which is an excellent section as it is, but quite frankly doesn't belong in a public procurement code. So what we did with those sections is take a look at things that are current, that we have not attempted to make any policy change here. But we've broken these preferences and these sections, some of which are specifications, not a preference per se, and we've broken them up and put them in the appropriate sections. So throughout this code, you'll see references to recycling materials, et cetera, and requirements to use such materials. We have put those preferences and requirements in appropriate places so that we don't put them all together in a way that doesn't make sense. Further, we've moved sections that don't belong in 279 out of 279. Legislative recycling program is retained, but it's been moved to a separate section of statute where it belongs and where it will be used.
Section 18 talks about the state procurement of goods and services, and this section is roughly analogous to Section 712 and 727 that currently govern state agencies' procurements. Because we've restructured the authority and the application at the front end of the chapter, some of those delineated authorities that state agencies have been moved into Section 7, I believe. So Section 18 can be truncated a little bit, but it is as it starts out, it is where state agencies, the Department of Administrative Services, shall conduct procurements for state agencies for goods, services, personal services, architectural, engineering, and related services. We are still working on we have an amendment that will come out, Amendment 1, that clarifies a couple of items in here. The sub 2 rules adopted by the department is really redundant with the rule section we've already gone over, so that would come out. The important part of 3 is that before a contract can be executed, it has to be reviewed by the Department of Justice for legal sufficiency. This syncs up with ORS 291, which gives the Department of Justice the authority to do legal sufficiency reviews and sets the limits for those. And then it also requires that before DAS would approve a contract, it would have had to have been reviewed for legal sufficiency by the Department of Justice.
Can I stop you there? Is that what current law also requires?
Madam Chair, that is correct. This is very consistent. This is consistent with current law.
Thank you.
Another highlight of this section is that it, again, says the department shall adopt rules necessary to implement the provisions of the section. And it has a reporting system, which is current law for personal services contracts, which will be preserved in this rewrite so that any of the reporting required by the legislature for personal services contract will continue to be provided. It gives DAS the ability to establish the procedures for screening and selection of personal services, so it would have the authority to establish the procedures in which source selection would be made. And it would also point to Section 50, which we'll talk about in subchapter 279B on methods of source selection for how we would acquire personal services contracts. Section 19, Section 20, and Section 21 are existing sections. There was really, in the middle of this whole chapter 279, there's this whole plethora of recycling preferences, recycling specifications, and it's kind of a mishmash of guidance to some specific to state agencies, some to local governments, not always the same direction. So we tried to untangle some of that and put it in the appropriate section. Jessica talked about the bulk of that in contract preferences, but Section 18, Section 20, and Section 21 are requirements that are specific to state agencies that state agencies must follow. And while we may have streamlined those, they are the same policy statements that currently exist in ORS 279. So requiring DAS to provide recycled product purchasing information is existing. The procurement of goods containing PETE, recycled polyethylene material, is the same. And then the 35% requirement for recycled content and paper is the same as in current statute. Section 22 is the first of 3 sections in intergovernmental relations, and I should say that we looked at the model procurement code for the section on intergovernmental relations and put what seemed to be applicable for Oregon in it, and we've talked about 3 specific sections that have to deal with intergovernmental relations, and then the main part of this Jessica will talk about is cooperative purchases. Section 22, though, allows for, and this is new, allows for purchases through the United States General Services Administration under certain conditions. The 2002, the Electronic Government Act of 2002, deals with electronic government on a federal level, but it also provided for state and local governments to buy information technology, equipment, and services, I believe, from federal GSA supply schedules. And we think that has got at least a tremendous potential opportunity for state and local governments to be able to buy off of the federal supply schedules for information technology. Now, we doubt that in all cases it means that it's going to be a savings of money. In fact, we think that our PC contracts that we have as part of the Western States Contracting Alliance probably drive better pricing for desktop computers than what we would get off of these federal supply schedules. But there are other types of equipment that are covered under this that will be very beneficial in terms of leveraging resources to be able to buy off of these federal supply schedules as well as pricing. So this gives us the ability to buy off of those federal supply schedules under that change of law. Another thing that we can access through this, and these are really the only two components that exist under federal law that would allow us to access their contract, is law enforcement equipment if for the purposes of drug interdiction and homeland security. Now, that program currently exists, and the way it's structured in the federal government is there has to be a single point of contact, and DAS is the single point of contact. But a local government can come in and buy law enforcement equipment off of GSA supply schedules, in some cases DOD equipment, the kinds of things that they would need for law enforcement that they couldn't buy elsewhere, and we probably couldn't be very effective in our buying power to buy. So it's very beneficial to the local governments. Right now, for them to come in and do that, they're having to do an exempted process because the procurement law would require them under 279 now, if it exceeds their threshold for bids, to go out and get a bid, even though the federal government has this available to them and wants to make this available. So this law allows for those two programs to be accessed without a competitive bid process.
Could you just tell us what DOD equipment, what does that stand for?
I think it even gets down into weapons and armament and maybe like SWAT team cars that they drive, that sort of equipment.
So that's Department of Defense?
Department of Defense.
Thank you.
Section 23, local contracting agencies, arrangements for use and disposal of personal property authorized. This is an existing statute. We haven't changed it. Allows local governments to dispose of surplus property. There may be one additional provision that we need to add in here. We want to make sure that we've got the disposal of surplus property adequately covered for local agencies. There was some question that came up about whether they, later on in the section, we'll talk about state surplus property, whether they were covered under that. They're not. We want to make sure that they haven't lost any authority to sell their surplus property. Section 24 is a relatively new section in statute, not new with this. It is an existing statute that allows for the transfer of fire protection equipment between fire departments. And I believe about two sessions ago this was added into statute. So there's no change in existing statute here.
Section 25 through Section 30 of this Act deal with cooperative procurements. Current cooperative procurement authority is one tiny little section in 279.015 that essentially says contracts between public agencies utilizing an existing contract are exempt from the code if the following conditions apply: that the original contract met the requirements of the chapter, the contract itself allows other public agencies to use the contract, and the original contracting agency, in other words, the agency that acquired that contract initially, will allow the second agency to buy off the contract. And those are the only requirements used in public cooperative procurement. Cooperative procurement, the whole idea of that is for agencies to come together to create buying power to find the best price. And there are some really good opportunities in this. It doesn't make sense for all purchases, but in some purchases, it does make a lot of sense. So what we've tried to do here is provide some guidance around cooperative procurements provide more clarity about the different kind of cooperative procurements available, and then kind of set some restrictions on an advertising requirements so that we don't neglect local contracting agencies and their ability to use them. The first kind of cooperative procurement that we have laid out are joint cooperative procurements. This is an instance, for example, say the city of Beaverton would like to go and acquire desks, and they go out and they establish a contract for desks, and then the city of Hillsborough finds out about the city of Beaverton contract, looks at it and says, well, that's probably a better deal than what we would be able to get through a purchase. I am now describing a permissive cooperative procurement. Let me start back. I apologize. Okay.
You could have fooled us.
Sorry. Jumping ahead because I'm so excited about the second one. But
Jessica, I was about ready to ask you. I was like, now, I'm sure you're talking about what you're talking about. So I'm glad that you got yourself.
Bless your heart, Representative. Let me go back and start over. All right. So the city of Beaverton and the city of Hillsborough both decide that they need desks. And so they decide generally how many desks that they might need and set out the same kind of contract terms and conditions, and both jointly go out and advertise such an opportunity to vendors. Vendors who are bidding on this contract know that it involves more than one agency, know that it may involve additional transportation costs, know generally how many desks are going to be procured and are going to be manufactured through this deal. So they are prepared and allowed and ready to address the needs of this joint procurement. Again, the idea is to create collective buying power for those procurements, and that is a joint cooperative procurement.
Madam Chair.
Representative Shoffler.
Thank you. Will this also relate to things like bulk purchasing of prescription drugs, too? Or is this outside of that?
Okay.
Let me just briefly talk about prescription drugs. There's a landmark case that says that cooperative purchases by public jurisdictions are okay as long as the purchase that public jurisdictions have come together to buy are for the purposes of government's operation. And if the government were to go together and buy in bulk and then resell that, then that would be competing with the marketplace in a way that could be considered to be a violation of antitrust. So this question of this is a very simple response to a very complex question around bulk drug buying, but there at least is one case that involved, actually I think Portland, Oregon was part of it, but where they held that you could buy drugs in bulk for the purposes of use within those jurisdictions. So one of the very important cooperative purchases that we are currently doing under an exemption is what we call the Minnesota multi-state. And there are 35 states, City of Chicago, a number of counties, have gone together and formed a joint cooperative purchase, as Jessica has described, where our entire volume of drugs is purchased by the state of Minnesota under their lead. We go back and evaluate it, and then we all buy from those laboratories that furnish drugs at the lowest price. But they are all for the use of the public jurisdiction. So when we bring on a county in that, we have to make sure that they are only dispensing those drugs as they would for the use of the government. And Minnesota has been very clear to tell us that we couldn't resell those drugs without violating that. So it's a bulk drug buying has a lot of facets and a lot of complexity to it, and we understand just a little bit of it. But this in itself, I don't think, opens up that avenue for bulk drug purchases beyond what we would use in administering our own programs.
Madam Chair, Representative Shoffler, the actual provisions that allow for us to use the Minnesota drug contract are not in Section 27, but in Section 29, that deal with interstate cooperative procurements. So in any event, this is Section 27. Section 28 deals with permissive cooperative procurements, which I began to describe a minute ago, in which one agency establishes a contract for desks or whatever, and the secondary agency comes in and would like to buy off of that contract. If the contract is for under $10,000, the requirements for allowing the secondary agency to purchase off of that original contract include that the contract was substantially equivalent to the contracting process for which the secondary agency is required to follow, that the contract allows for the second agency to purchase off of the initial contract, that the first contracting agency will allow the second contracting agency to purchase off of that contract, and finally, that the contractor itself will allow the second contracting agency to purchase off of the original contract. If it is over $10,000, all of those requirements that I just described apply, but in addition, the contracting agency that would like to enter into the cooperative procurement, the second agency that I just described, must go through a noticing requirement. They must follow generally the procedures of advertising that are laid out in both the B and C side for advertising an opportunity to bid. They must include we call it an advertisement of notice of intent to enter into a contract under a cooperative procurement, permissive cooperative procurement, and it requires a certain amount of time to allow for public comment. If public comment is received, the public contracting agency must respond. They have a choice. They can either continue with the procurement, in which case they have to justify why it's worth doing so and why they believe they will achieve certain ends. If they choose not to proceed, they need to let people know that as well, but they can back off and go out to bid for that work. The intent of this is to ensure that agencies who go out and try and enter into cooperative procurements for several items are doing so while being sensitive to the local marketplace, so that agencies don't just go out and purchase off of cooperative procurements going and kind of bypassing the competitive bidding process. They are going and doing those purchases only where there's significant cost savings. And in addition, it gives the local business community the opportunity to come in and say, you know, we can provide this for you. You need to send this out to bid in our community because we can provide this service, and you need to hear from us about whether this is something that we can provide you. We are trying to make sure that this doesn't run afoul of ethical business practices, but in addition provide some accountability for local agencies to the local marketplace.
And Jessica, the $10,000 amount would be a fairly low amount. Is that why you chose that? How did you arrive at that number?
Representative Close, it was a product of negotiation. We sat down with agencies and started to ask what the numbers were in terms of how big of a contract and how many cooperative procurements they do over that level, because generally cooperative procurements are done at a fairly small level. They go out and they find small things so that they can get kind of get by the cost of bidding those things, which is substantial. However, what we want to try to avoid is setting that number too high so that small local businesses who would be able to provide something at $15,000 or at $8,000 aren't bypassed in this process as well.
Okay. Thank you.
And Section 29 deals with interstate cooperative procurements. This section is what would allow purchases off of the Minnesota drug contract and other interstate procurements. For example, there are many western states that come together to buy off of to purchase IT equipment, desktop computers from Dell, for example. And those kinds of procurements can be done best with large purchasing power. And it makes sense in instances where it is you're buying from a national corporation where locally you can't procure those kinds of things, and for commodities that are market and bulk sensitive, it makes sense to get as many people together as possible to purchase that item, because that's the best deal for the state. These are instances where local providers wouldn't be able to provide this product, but for which going through an interstate cooperative procurement, you can achieve the best end for the local agency. What we've required here is in the instance where you want to do an interstate cooperative procurement, that either if the state is listed up front, or an agency is listed up front in an essence an interstate joint cooperative procurement, and it's advertised that we'll be participating, and it's advertised in Oregon that we will be participating, then you can do interstate cooperative procurement. If we are not listed up front as an agency that may participate in this cooperative procurement, then we have to go back on the back end once the contract is established and ensure that we have advertised properly in the state of Oregon. So we will go out and have to advertise that we are intending to enter in this contract, and also make sure that the original contract allows us to enter into that. Further, a major requirement of an interstate cooperative procurement is that it is that the procedures that are under which this interstate cooperative procurement is acquired are substantially equivalent to our own 279 requirements. It must take place through a competitive bidding process, either under an RFP or under a low bid scenario. They don't have to be exactly the same, because not every state is going to have exactly the same advertising requirements, et cetera, et cetera. But we have defined and worked to define substantially equivalent to mean you have some process, and it has to be competitive, and there has to be an advertising requirement, et cetera, et cetera. It doesn't have to be 100% like ours, but it has to be similar. So the idea is that you don't have another state go out and just buy off of whoever because their law doesn't require them to go out through a competitive bidding process, but rather we have to be assured they have done it competitively so that Oregon taxpayers have faith that we are, again, circumventing the public contracting law to just go buy off of somebody because there's a relationship there. Does that make sense? Okay. Finally, we've allowed a protest and dispute process, which falls under the legal remedies of 279B, and essentially allows an aggrieved party to file a protest or dispute of this process.
I'm going to stop you at this point. We're through 20 pages of 184 pages, so we probably need to pick it up just slightly. I also wanted to announce to the committee that I had said there would be public testimony today, but we don't have anybody signed up on the sheet, so we will continue with the overview unless there are people who did want to speak today. Was there anyone that did want to comment today? Okay. Please continue.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, this next section should go quickly. Products and services of disabled individuals. This section mirrors 279.835 to 279.855 and establishes a process by which state agencies and other agencies purchase off of qualified rehabilitation facilities if the products and services that they provide are of the same availability within the market price, etc., that are able to be achieved in the marketplace. The policy and goal here is to enable disabled individuals to work in an environment and produce something that is positive. So that is kind of the overriding goal, and for the state and for contracting agencies to encourage such activity, there is a requirement to purchase from such agencies. We have attempted and have done our level best not to create a policy change here. There are some changes which we are taking back. The first is that we change disabled individual to individual with a disability. We have removed that in our First Amendment, or rather an amendment we are creating separate and apart from this. We'll take this and turn it back to disabled individual. We have changed a caption title, which has no force of law. We are changing it back. And there are some other word changes here, which we are going to attempt to change back. We are looking at an opportunity to perhaps remove this section and move it to another section of law and provide tie-ins. It is not our intention to change any of the statutory meaning, any of the historic agreements, any of the current anything with regard to this section. We are aware that this is highly politically sensitive, and we do not want to change policy. We don't want to enhance it or detract from its current meaning. I'm not sure I can say it any stronger than that.
Thank you.
Next section. Bill, you've got surplus property?
Yes. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Bill Nestle of the Department of Justice again. I think it can be real quick in the nine sections from pages 23 through 26. This is the revision of the existing law regarding the state surplus property program. The Department of Administrative Services is the command post agency. The main resource in this area is, of course, the federal government, which from time to time makes its surplus property available to the state. Federal law requires a main state contact, which is DAS, and it acts as somewhat of a liaison, acquiring federal property on behalf of itself, other state agencies, local government agencies in Oregon, and certain nonprofit charitable organizations that are in the private sector. In that respect, these laws remain pretty much the same, except that we have provided a more rational definition of who may receive property under the program. Donee is broadly defined as being anyone who's eligible to receive property under federal regulations. Property is restricted in this sense to personal property. You don't deal in real estate. We've determined that there are other chapters, or as Chapter 270 gives state agencies adequate controls and authority to dispose of excess or surplus real property, and local government bodies through their own home rule charters or their own ordinances can regulate that themselves. So this is strictly a personal property statute. And subject to that slight adjustment or recognition that we're only dealing with personal property, this is pretty much the way existing law is, although it's a lot easier to read. It also contains authority for the Department of Administrative Services to dispose of personal property that's excess to the state's needs. It does that for itself and also on behalf of other state agencies. The one significant change is in section 42. It's page 25, lines 21 through 24, which is new authority that allows the department to recycle or otherwise dispose of property when it determines that the value and condition of the property doesn't warrant the cost of putting it up for sale. In other words, if the transaction to get rid of the property costs more than the property is worth, they don't have to jump through that hoop. And unless you have questions, I think I would end the surplus property discussion and takes us to section 45.
Questions on that section? Okay.
Section 45 is a new section. It deals with concession contracts. It doesn't exist in current law. It does a couple of things. It defines a concession contract, and there is some feedback we've received around this definition, and we may be proposing an amendment to it, but as it currently stands at this point, concession contract is one in which a contractor takes a financial risk under a contract with a public entity in return for the right to charge others for that service. And then we go on to say that that gross receipts amount, the amount of gross receipts, is how we figure out the volume of that contract or how big that contract is for the purposes of deciding how to procure it. Some might argue, since, at least under old law, since there's no expenditure of public funds, maybe that award of that contract could be done in ways other than a full competitive bid process. So what we've done is we've said, you figure out the value of the concession contract based on the estimated gross receipts, and then you
acquire that contract as you would with any other procurement under Section 50, which either goes to a bid or an RFP for that contract. We further say that in the event that that concession contractor will be doing public improvements, because sometimes that actually could happen, they might build a concession within a facility and make some improvements to it, that anything related to public improvement would have to be done under the section of 279C. So this could not be used as a mechanism to have a third party under a concession contract that was acquired under 279B do public improvements that should be subject to 279C. So we made it clear that anything related to public improvements is covered under 279C. The concession contract, the acquisition of it is under 279 or is under Section 50, the methods of source selection. And furthermore, we've said that for the purposes of award, if you're using a bid under Section 51, then you don't have to award to the low bidder. You can award to who will give you the most return. Section 46 deals with penalties. This is not a new section. This is currently an existing statute, and we've simply cross-mapped these sections that applied in the old chapter to the current section in the new chapter that would be applicable. And that concludes what we have in ORS 279A, which are the provisions that relate to both public improvements and non-public improvement contracting. Now we're going to talk about sections 47 through 87.
And hey, before we go on, does the committee have any questions on Section A, this major change in sections? Okay, you guys did a good job. Thank you.
The next sections deal with everything other than public works, public improvement contracting, architectural engineering, and related services. And this part really did kind of start more with a clean sheet of paper as opposed to a rewrite of existing statute. And so we looked at the model code, and what we're going to talk about next really takes from the model, I think, the approach to it, the methods of source selection, the model code. The definitions here in Section 47 are definitions that apply to 279B. 48 is a placeholder, and it's on policy for public improvement, and that will be in amendment number one. And there are basically three sort of discrete bullets that talk about innovation. They talk about results, that trying to get effective public outcomes is an important part of this. And they talk a little bit, I think, about competition as well as it relates to 279B. They also point back and say, in addition to those other policy considerations that we talked about in Section 3. Section 49, procurement of recycled and reusable goods. All contracting agencies shall establish procurement practices to ensure the maximum extent economically feasible for the procurement of goods that may be recycled or reused when discarded. This is out of existing statute again. We felt that it fit in there about as well as any place. The next few sections 50 through 57, really deal with the methods of source selection. And this replaces ORS 279.15, which says we'll do everything as a competitive bid or proposal with these exemptions. And here we've tried to be more specific. And I think this is really a centerpiece and a strong point of providing consistency in public procurement throughout all public agencies. Section 50 says that we will acquire any kinds of contracts through either a competitive bid or a competitive proposal process. So Section 51 governs competitive bids. Section 52 governs competitive sealed proposals. Sub 2 goes on to say, in effect, that you can use something other than a competitive bid or competitive proposal process if you follow one of these other sections, which is if you have an emergency, if it is a sole source, if it is a special procurement, if it's an intermediate procurement, or if it's a small procurement. So it sets out those other methods of source selection that you may use under the conditions that are prescribed within those subsections. Section 51, I should also say that on 4 sub 4B allow state agencies and to procure their personal services contracts through sections 50 through 57. So this says if you're a state agency, you're acquiring a personal services contract, you can use one of these methods of source selection. It doesn't make a distinction between personal services, supplies, or services. Section 51 describes the competitive sealed bidding process. It takes from existing statute those requirements that didn't apply to public improvement contracts, so it's been able to streamline that a bit, and requires those things to be posted in bids for proposed or bids for services and supplies. And it says that the contracting agency has to be identified, the contact person has to be identified, scope of work has to be identified. And it goes on to prescribe in almost cookbook fashion what any public agency needs to do when they're putting an invitation to bid together. It identifies that when a contract is awarded under a competitive bid, they have to take in applicable preferences. The award of a competitive bid must be made to the lowest responsible bidder whose bid substantially complies with the requirements set forth in the bid criteria. It also allows for a competitive bid to be used with a multiple award approach. Right now we have some difficulty with that because current law says you award to the lowest responsible bidder. And if you have multiple awards, which is popular with suppliers as well as agencies, a very efficient way to use resources, it's kind of hard to reconcile that, so we resolve that problem here. So there's really kind of a cookbook approach to how you put together an invitation to bid and what's required in an invitation to bid. Section 52 then has an analogous section to the bidding process. There's not much said in current statute about how you do a competitive sealed proposal, so here we walk through it. What the proposal must contain, the time and the date, the statement of work. The proposal must announce the method of contractor selection, which may include, but is not limited to, negotiations with the highest ranked proposal, competitive negotiations, multi-tiered competition designed to identify a class of proposals that fall within a competitive range, or otherwise eliminate from consideration a class of lower ranked proposals. It allows for a competitive solicitation process where you would identify kind of a short list, and you would then tell these people have met the initial cut and we're going to negotiate with those or evaluate with those. It allows for a process when there is the short list for within that competitive range for them to come back in and get notice around that. It requires all the evaluation factors to be included in the RFP. So a competitor who gets this knows how that decision making is going to be made and doesn't permit decision making to be made on items that weren't included in that RFP process. And finally, it says that if a contract is awarded, the contracting agency shall award the contract to the responsible proposal whose proposal the contracting agency determines in writing to be the most advantageous to the contracting agency based on the evaluation factors set forth in the request for proposal.
What are you reading right there? Is that section 10?
This is sub 9 on page 33.
Okay.
It goes on to say that other factors may not... Oh, thank you very much. Other factors may not be used in the evaluation. So it's a fairly detailed approach to how competitive sealed proposals may be used. It provides some additional flexibility, but provides a tremendous amount of guidance to both the supplier community and the public agencies who would use this. So those are the two basic foundation pieces in the methods of source selection, and it allows the procurement officer in a public agency to pick the one that's best suited to accomplish the job. In some cases it may be an invitation to bid, in some cases it may be a proposal. Section 53 describes small procurements, and this is essentially one of the exemptions in current statute, which says if it's under $5,000 that you would that you do not have to go to a competitive process. It can be done in accordance with rules adopted by the agency. And it does include a pretty, I think, important provision, which says under sub 2 that a procurement may not artificially be fragmented. So you can't say, well, I'm going to take a what would have been a $100,000 project or bid, and I'm going to break it up into little chunks, and I'm going to buy each of them under my authority at $5,000. Can't artificially fragment it or break it up. So this decontrols, which I think is the intent of current statute, the small expenditures, so we're not spending a whole lot of process time where the value is relatively low, but yet there are some requirements here. Section 54 then takes the $5,000 to $75,000 and requires three quotes. So the competitive level range in this case is to get three quotations if they're available. Again, it can't be artificially fragmented. Section 55 describes the sole source, what the conditions are for sole source. The director of DAS may determine a sole source. The local contract review board may determine a sole source. It must be based on findings that may include the efficient utilization of existing goods, require the acquisition of compatible goods or services, that the goods or services required for the exchange of software or data with other public or private agencies are available from only one source, that the goods or services are used in a pilot or experimental project, or that other findings that support the conclusion that the goods or services are available from only one source. So there are some specific requirements that aren't dealt with right now in ORS 279, but are largely dealt with through exempted procurements under the exemption process. So we put them right into statute. Emergency procurements is dealt with under Section 56, and they are essentially what's in current statute, although we have had some discussion with the City of Eugene about maybe making some changes here. And the issue that they've raised is we've said that that a head of a contracting agency may make an emergency procurement under rules. They have to make a determination that the emergency procurement needed to take place when circumstances existed that could not have reasonably been foreseen, that create a substantial risk for loss, damage, or interruption of service, or potential threat to property, public health, welfare, safety, and require the prompt award of a public contract. Contracting agency shall document the nature of the emergency and describe the method for the use of selecting that particular contract. City of Eugene's question, I think it's a good one, is this question of could not have reasonably been foreseen. Some might argue, like the traditional flood situation, maybe there is an ODOT location that happens to be, a highway camp happens to be within a 100-year floodplain. Maybe one could argue that you could reasonably foresee that there would have been a flood there, but if there is a flood and they need to take emergency action, could that have reasonably been foreseen? So there's some question about that. But this is pretty consistent with, I think, most definitions of emergency, loss or damage or protection of property or public safety or health.
Could I ask one quick question? Up in Section 55, and you talk about the sole source procurements, the contracting agency shall negotiate, but then you've got that preceded by the words to the extent reasonably practical. I'm just wondering why you wouldn't always require negotiations, why you would put those three words in there. I guess that's for Mr.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Nessa with Justice again, and I just had a circumstance when we were drafting this in which you may be familiar with the electronically coded tags they put into salmon, and then they can just run them through and get the data when the fish come back. It's a process that is wrapped up in copyright and patent law, where an outfit up in the state of Washington has the whole lock on it, and negotiation is can you do this, and the answer is no, because we've got other people that we can sell these to, and we only have so much capacity. So that's why that language is there, and it's the only reason it's there.
Okay, thank you.
I think we want public agencies to get the best deal they can on behalf of their jurisdiction. So in some cases you can, even though there is only one source, negotiate, but if they're the only game in town, how far you can push them is really dependent on what they're going to agree to.
Okay, thank you.
Special procurements in Section 57 replaces the exemption process that's in current statute 279.015. And it allows that there are certain circumstances in which the director of administrative services or the local contract review board may make a determination to do a special procurement.
It allows for special procurement to be done as an individual procurement, or they can make a determination as a class of procurement. And those circumstances are covered under sub 2, and it says that they would demonstrate that a situation exists in which the use of a special procurement method exempt from all or part of the requirements applicable to competitive sealed bidding or competitive sealed proposals or in many procurements would be necessary, and that it would be unlikely to encourage favoritism in the awarding of the public contract or substantially diminish competition for public contracts. That's right out of existing statute as it relates to an exemption under 279 currently. Or B, and B, result in substantial cost savings to the contracting agency. That's right out of existing statute. Now, the next piece is not. Or to the public. So it has to, you can't encourage favoritism or substantially diminish competition, and it has to result in cost savings to the contracting agency or to the public. And the or to the public is new. You look at this literally, cost savings to the contracting agency, in some cases, like in state procurement, that may be the agency who's actually doing the contracting. Well, at least we ought to be looking at savings to the state, and sometimes it's broader than just to that one contracting agency. And I think this is a very important improvement here, because it should be really to the public. In some cases, if you do the cost-benefit analysis, it may be more expensive to do something for the contracting agency, but there may be tremendous benefit and savings to the public at large, and that ought to be considered into this discussion. Bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I just can't resist. Actually, we need to give credit where credit is due in trying to recognize benefit to the public. We stole that from the legislature. In the special session, you enacted some laws to facilitate and fund emergency bridge restoration that use this very same word, because by going out and making those contracts, the public contracting agency, ODOT, wasn't saving any money, but the public, the trucking industry and the people that depend on that flow of commerce and the direct lines as opposed to huge expensive detours benefited from it. And so we, in the drafting activity, we stole that idea and hope you'll approve of it.
Thank you. Sounds very good to me.
So that's the first test. So either it has to meet that test. If it doesn't meet that test, there's a second test, and it's an or, so it can meet either one. And the second test is it could otherwise substantially promote the public interest in a manner that could not practically be realized by complying with the requirements applicable under Section 51, 52, or 54. And what that does is it says that if for some reason the public interest can't be met through a competitive bid process or a competitive sealed proposal process or an intermediate procurement, then you can craft a special procurement to meet those needs, to work within the marketplace, and to meet those outcomes. But you have to make that determination. The special procurement piece we took out of the model procurement code, and we sort of modified it to include in the current level of exemption that we've talked about earlier with that one modification that Bill mentioned. But the reason that this went into the model procurement code is that as market and the business environment changed, the public procurement arena wasn't really keeping up with that. So one of the changes that they made in 1999 when they rewrote it was they added in the special procurement section, which allows for public agencies, when the bid process isn't going to work or the RFP process isn't going to work, but to craft a process that's calculated to reach the kinds of outcomes to serve the public. It has to be competitive. It has to have a notice of intent to award. But it does allow you to design something when the other processes don't work.
Chair Close, members of the committee, the practical application of this is, I mean, every once in a while we hear of kind of really big projects that are very technical and involve a lot of different public agencies and negotiating with a private vendor. You can think of projects like PGE Park and all of those people that involve local governments and negotiation and all of those kinds of things for which an RFP process isn't going to work, a competitive bid process isn't going to work. None of these processes will work, but you can kind of create your own procurement process that makes the most sense in that deal, that isn't an exemption per se, but is and allows public agencies to get to where they need to go with some guidance on how to get there.
Madam Chair.
Representative Merkley.
You know, I'm not sure that PGE Park is the best example to put forward before the committee, given the circumstances that now exist up there. Could you give us some other examples that don't... You've laid out a number of special exceptions to a competitive bidding process. This one seems to basically be a door that anything could be driven through. The determination of what's unlikely to encourage favoritism or a determination that something will result in substantial cost savings is a pretty subjective standard. Do other states have this type of provision? What keeps us from being subjected to abuse?
Representative Close, Representative Merkley, these provisions are kind of mirrored in the current exemption law, which is, by some people's estimation, the findings required there are relatively loose and allow anything to be driven through it. Now, I think that the guidance in the front end about use of the competitive bid process and use of the competitive proposal process and the requirements here that generally this is the procurement method of last resort. Essentially, you have something that is unique, something that is special, that allows you to use a process and requires you to use a process that is different and distinct than anything else that you have provided in advance. Perhaps the PGE Park example is the best example of this, because right now that process happened through an exemption and it wasn't necessarily guided by some process here. And I think that this provision and the requirements underneath of it will result in better procurement practices in those kinds of unique situations, with additional guidance around how those situations ought to exist and how you ought to operate underneath of them.
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, special procurement sections do exist in some other states. I'm at least aware of two that have very similar provisions, some of which actually what the model code was looked at when they updated theirs. In addition, I think an important part of this is that this type of procurement must be noticed after a determination, at least. There is a noticing process, so it's not as though you can simply do anything you want. It really gives you the ability, if you can't be successful within the cookbook solutions for competitive bid and competitive seal proposal, if somehow they're not working somewhere, you can put something together that doesn't have a piece of that in there, yet it is a public process. It does have to have a notice of intent to award, so there's an opportunity for the supplier community to come in and raise their hand and say, wait a minute, we don't think you're awarding this properly. In addition, at least for state agencies operating under this, it would not be free from review of the Department of Justice for legal sufficiency. So it would have to have a legal sufficiency review before the solicitation went out, and then it would have to have a legal sufficiency review before a contract were executed as well. So there really are some safeguards that are built into this beyond just that determination process.
Follow up. This legal sufficiency review that you just mentioned that has to be done before the contract is awarded, what does that look like? We hereby determine that this is eligible for a special procurement procedure because ...
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, I'm going to turn that answer over to Bill Nestle from the Department of Justice. They are the ones who conduct that review under 291.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, actually the legal sufficiency review required by ORS Chapter 291 only requires us to look at the face of the contract that is entered into. As a matter of practice, we work hand in glove with agencies like DAS and ODOT in reviewing the exemption orders that are issued today under current law. I think what I'd like to emphasize is, or at least give you an idea about what this is all about, is when Mr. Petty said that these have to be noticed, the cross-reference says that you can't do this in the dark. You have to develop a written statement of the reasons why this proposed different procurement process will either, well, it has to do both. It has to not adversely impact competition in a substantial way, and it also has to save money for either the contracting agency or the public. And then you've got to go out and publish that, those findings, in at least one newspaper of general circulation in the area where the contract is to be performed. So it has to be out there in front of the public. And what doesn't show up on page 35 is the fact that in the legal remedies provision, we have also drafted, it hasn't been incorporated into this document yet, a procedure for, number one, filing an administrative protest with the agency that issues the determination that a special procurement is okay. And if the party doesn't like that, there's a second step that permits them to go to court and challenge that in a judicial proceeding. So there is a judicial review backup, too.
Thank you very much for expanding the framework. I think it's so important to the public that we have a process where we don't see on the back end of it articles about bypassing a reasonable process and insider contracts or the public not getting the best value on their dollars. So thank you for expanding on those provisions.
Please continue.
Madam Chair, to continue, unless there are other questions on special procurements, I'll move to Section 58. Section 58 covers cancellation, rejection, delay of invitation to bids, and competitive sale proposal. This is the process in which an invitation to bid might be canceled or in part rejected. This is consistent with existing statute and existing practice. Section 59 deals with the responsibility of bidders and proposers. It is, we've taken existing criteria for responsibility from existing 279, no change in that. This does flip the determination of responsibility over to a determination of non-responsibility. So an agency, when they are determining, having to make a determination, they must make a determination when the contractor is not responsible. So it's I like that better because it makes the assumption that the contractors, which I think is a correct assumption, are responsible to begin with. And that is the correct assumption for contractors we deal with in state. But it does give the ability when we have a contractor who doesn't meet the requirements here set out in existing statute to determine that they are not a responsible contractor.
It's working.
I'll carry on. Section 60 deals with qualified products list. This is a new section. I think it is a good section that it gives public agencies another tool to be effective. And it allows, under structured circumstances, to have tests of products that would be offered and then decide what test meets the requirements that the agency needs and then limit future bids to those particular products that have been tested. Requires the agency to do noticing of that, requires them to have an objective testing process, and very importantly, it allows for suppliers to challenge that, to challenge those tests. So it is, if you will, under current law, we allow for a pre-qualification process of contractors, where we look at the contractor and make sure the contractor has the ability to carry out the work. That's largely a public improvement, public works section, and all of that has gone over to public improvement, public works. We've kept some piece of that in the 279B because we think it makes some sense for other applications as well. But this is the product piece of that. Rather than qualifying a contractor, we're qualifying a product. This is from model code, and we think it makes some sense.
Section Can I ask you on these tests and these examinations, would there be an extra cost to agencies? Would they absorb that cost? Would they be paying that cost of the test?
Madam Chair, I think it could happen both ways. I mean, the agencies could do it, or they could require the supplier to submit it for testing purposes. Oftentimes, they would do it. I've used this in times where we've tested paper products, make sure the paper goes through, so we've asked them to furnish a case of paper, and most of the time they're happy to do that. If it were a very expensive item, it would be possible for the agency to say, we will pay for this first amount, but we haven't been specific about that.
Okay, thank you.
Section 61 deals with pre-qualification of prospective bidders and proposers. This is essentially a light version of what went over in 279, allowing us to do pre-qualification of the contractor. I spoke of that earlier. Section 62 allows us to create applications for pre-qualification. Not a whole lot of change in either one of these, other than the application for pre-qualification is up to the contracting agency doing the pre-qualification. It's not a requirement that DAS do it, which is the current statute. Section 63 deals with the debarment of prospective bidders and proposers. We haven't made a change in existing statute other than to title this debarment rather than disqualification, because debarment is really what it is. If a contractor is really a bad apple and they run afoul of criteria that's set out in current statute, the public jurisdiction has the right to debar them from conducting procurements for some period of time, up to 3 years. We've made no policy changes here other than just change the term from disqualification to debarment, which is more accurate. Section 64 is notice of intent to award. I think this is an important section because all of those, Section 51 when we talked about invitation to bid, Section 52 when we talked about competitive seal proposal, all of them require a notice of intent to award to be issued. Now, right now, there's not a consistent process within public agencies or even with the state on using notice of intent to award. We happen to use it at DAS, and I know other jurisdictions do, but it's up to them. We think it's good policy to issue a notice of intent to award because that becomes the protest period, if you will. We haven't made the award. We said we intend to award it to this contractor, and here's the spread on the bids, and that allows, under a section that Mr. Nestle will talk about shortly, if a contractor says, wait a minute, I think that's wrong, I want to protest the award of that contract to so-and-so because I really don't think they were a little better for these reasons, then they can come in and protest it. So by having that notice of intent to award, it signals the beginning of that protest period. And it also builds consistency in across the landscape of public jurisdictions on how they award their public contracts. And we've put in here that it must be at least 7 days before the award of a contract that the notice of intent go out. That's actually 2 more days than what we do right now on the state side. So I think this goes a long ways to building consistency in these public contracting award processes.
I have a question. Up there in Section 63, it's line 1 on page 39, you've got, you know, that the bidder has been convicted under state and federal statutes, but then you've got any other offense indicating a lack of business integrity or business honesty. That seems really wide open, and I'm wondering why that's in there.
Well, that is, I believe, exactly current statute, and I think it was intended to have some broad discretion in that area, Madam Chair.
But legally, could I ask you, Mr. Nestle, you know, in a court of law, that sounds like a case could be made for, you know, having DUIs or something. I don't know.
I'm not aware, and this is existing language in current ORS 279.037 sub 2 sub B. I'm not aware of a case that construes it, but it does have to relate. I'm pretty clear, at least in light of some licensing board decisions where they said that your bad activity had to have some relationship, direct relationship, with your ability to perform in the profession for which you're licensed, that this would have to relate to the contracting activity of a public agency. I think that's as far as I can reasonably go because it hasn't been construed by a court, but there are some restrictions.
Now, is that in statute?
That
has to relate those words?
No, it isn't. It's in some case law that has to do with somewhat similar means of jerking a license of certain licensed professionals. There's a recent real estate licensure case that I might be able to provide you this afternoon if you'd like to see it and give you an idea how the courts have sort of held behavior. It has to be not something that's sort of on the side or unrelated to the profession, but it has to be within the performance of professional duties. And we probably would get somewhat of a construction similar under one of these disqualifications if it was appealed.
It would be nice if it said any other offense that relates, you know, that you have those words in here.
And we could propose...
Representative Shoffler.
Thank you. What would generate a debarment? Would it be somebody who just doesn't fulfill their contract or doesn't do good work? When if the community just fired them, went and hired somebody to fill in their place, would that immediately generate a debarment, or would the community have to come to the state and file a claim or something? Or what would generate that?
Madam Chair, Representative Shoffler, in those instances, it would be up to the contracting agency to decide that they want to go through debarment proceedings with the contractor. The community may be in such an uproar that the contracting agency decides that that's the method that they would like to pursue, but it is up to the contracting agency to begin those proceedings. It's not another entity that starts the debarment proceedings, but the contracting agency. There may be a desire on part of individuals to raise the issue with the contracting agency, but again, it is the contracting agency itself that that begins those proceedings.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Shoffler, the criteria talks about convicted of a criminal offense as an incident to an obtaining or attempting to obtain a public contract or subcontract. It goes on to talk about prospective bidder proposal has been convicted of state or federal statutes of embezzlement, forgery, bribery, falsification, destruction of records, stolen property, indicating a lack of business integrity. So there are some criteria in there that is fairly clear in terms of having been somehow convicted or documented to have kind of part of a practice that would justify debarment under the statute. If you simply decided not to award to a contractor, or there were some performance issues that never got completely documented, those wouldn't rise to the level of criteria here to support the bar, and it couldn't just be a decision made. As Jessica said, there is a process and a proceeding that would be gone through where a contract would have the ability to come in and contest that and have that basis understood clearly. So it's not at the whim of a public agency to decide they don't want to do business with someone.
Madam Chair, Representative Shoffler, there is some potential disagreement in the contracting community over some of those provisions. For example, under the award of contract, it requires that you have a satisfactory record of integrity and satisfactory record of responsibility. Those are the responsibility determinations. So if a contracting agency finds in the now in this side the determination of non-responsibility, the contractor, because of past performance or past actions in a contract, they don't meet the standards of responsibility, that they can refuse to award the contract. In fact, they're required not to award the contract to that contractor. Further, in terms of debarment proceedings, if you look at subsection 2 sub D, it talks about the prospective bidder or proposer has committed a violation of a contract provision that is regarded by the contracting agency to be so serious as to justify debarment. So in that instance, say they have been in breach of contract for something, whatever the agency deems to be serious, and are thrown off the project, that could trigger a debarment proceeding if the agency determines that is so serious as to justify debarment. That is, gives the agency latitude to begin debarment proceedings based on serious actions by the contractor.
Okay, committee, we are right at 10:30, so I want to thank the presenters. We're just a few pages from Chapter 279C, so we will intend to go on Wednesday with this testimony. And thank you very much for your attention. I know it's been long and difficult. Anything else for the good of the committee? If none, we are adjourned.